Well, back to this Sunday afternoon. It's 2:05 and time for the Early Music Show with Lucy Skeeping.
Welcome to the Early Music Show. I'm joined today by a guest, the lutenist Elizabeth Kenny. Now, if you collect early music CDs or if you go to concerts, you'll almost certainly have seen her name. She plays with just about every group on today's scene, both here in the UK and abroad. Les Arts Florissants, the English Concert, the Gabrielli Consort, the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, English National Opera and lots more. Not to mention duo recitals with singers such as Mark Padmore, Robin Blaise and Ian Bostridge. We're going to be chatting today about two of the modern lutenists who've influenced her as performers, teachers, musicologists, and in a way, I suppose you could say, general mentors. But before I tell you who they are, let's hear them.
Thank you.
music for lutes, My Lord Chamberlain's Galliard and My Lady Hunsdon's Puff, performed by Nigel North and Robert Spencer, both of them musicians whose pioneering work in those first years of the early music revival was such an important influence on my guest today, the lutenist Elizabeth Kenny. Welcome, Liz. Those are wonderful titles, aren't they?
Yes, and the first one is actually a musical joke. The Lord Chamberlain's Galliard is for two to play on one lute. So you hear the different sounds changing as one player has to get out the way for the other one, and they swap hands between the high and the low bits. And then the second piece was actually for the Lord Chamberlain's wife, Lady Hunsdon.
I know, like so many lutenists, you actually began as a guitarist. What was your first encounter with the lute?
Well, I think it was probably in quite a subliminal way in my early teens. I discovered actually while preparing for this programme that my dad had bought one of the records that we're going to play in the early 80s, which featured James Bowman and Robert Spencer. And I'd sort of forgotten about it for a while, but it was a very early influence. And I was particularly interested in it because it had a lot of English repertoire and a lot of beautiful poetry on it, as well as beautiful music. But at the time, I was quite interested in playing the guitar and only later made the connection that you could actually play these works on the lute as well.
Tell me a little about Robert Spencer, because not everyone will be familiar with his name.
In the 60s, when he was really starting his career, there wasn't much in terms of the lute out there in the mainstream musical life, if you like. On the continent, there'd been a lot of interest in reviving early music instruments from pioneers like Nicholas Harnoncourt and other players, but they didn't really include the lute. So over here in England, Robert was really introducing the lute to composers like Benjamin Britten, for example. He played in the St. John Passion that Britten had conducted, and then met Peter Peers, and gradually introduced the idea that particularly the English school of lute players and songwriters were as central to the early music revival as all the other mainstream composers like Bach and Handel, which had already been played by other people. And he was drawing on work done in the previous generation by Diana Poulton and even Arnold Dolmetsch at the end of the 19th century. But it wasn't until he was, if you like, getting the lute out on the road, playing concerts all over the country, doing some recordings as well, and working with all these other distinguished musicians, that lute music and the lute repertoire really made its way into people's minds.
He was an incredibly generous person, if I remember. I knew him a little, and I remember, you know, he was the sort of chap you could ring up and ask about some music or borrow some. He had a huge collection of lutes and of music, didn't he?
Yes, his house in Woodford Green became a real focus for anyone really interested, not only in the lute, but in the whole context of 16th and 17th century music. You would just go in there and find a treasure trove of books about all sorts of musical and literary themes. You'd find paintings, you'd find engravings, and an awful lot of music, which you would just be left alone with to browse and then really slap on a photocopier and walk away with in the most amazingly free manner. He had the most extraordinarily wide-ranging intellectual curiosity.
Sadly, he died about 10 years ago, didn't he? But let's hear a piece now. This is him with wonderful James Bowman. What are we going to hear?
We're going to hear actually two short tracks, a piece called Gray's Inn Mask, which is a little theatrical tune. And the theatre was something which was very important to Bob and kind of coloured his whole approach to music making. He did a lot of live theatre work, and that was what was very central to him was moving people in a very theatrical way. And then we're going to hear In Darkness Let Me Dwell, the great masterpiece of John Dowland that Bob played with Alfred Deller and then with James Bowman. And I think this is one of the signature performances, really, of this piece. In fact, I remember years later having the honour of playing it with James, and my nervousness was so great that I rather rushed the introduction. And I remember him just looking at me and saying, well, that was a bit like an express train. And when I played it with Bob, of course, the timing was quite right. So I think you'll hear that on this track. Thank you.
anonymous English tune Grays in Mosque, and John Dowland's extraordinary song In Darkness Let Me Dwell. And that was the lutenist Robert Spencer with the countertenor James Bowman. Elizabeth Kenny, you were saying how Spencer was such an important influence. The next generation after Spencer also spawned a very, very influential figure, Nigel North. Tell us something about him.
Yes, well, Nigel is somebody who's had already and is continuing to enjoy a very long career. He started playing the lute when he was very young. So he actually also appears on all these what are now quite early recordings of the 70s. But, of course, he's still going, producing many wonderful recordings and performances. So he sort of spans what, in a way, was a slightly changing approach to the lute, a bit more specialist and with a slightly different technical approach. But he and Bob continue to be very close colleagues, and I think it's fair to say that they exchanged ideas with each other, and it was a very collaborative experience.
Tell me about this business about technique, because I remember, you know, some decades ago, this business about, you know, do you play with the nails, do you play with the flesh? That seemed to be what all the lutenists were talking about earlier on. And indeed, it's a very different sound, whatever you do.
It is, and it was one of the big watersheds of the late 70s, early 80s, which almost divided the world into people who played with nails and people who didn't. Of course, in the 17th century, people did both, and we're coming to realise that more now, that a variety of different approaches are appropriate and can be very creative. At the time, it did feel sometimes like you joined one camp or another. So I do remember the moment when one jumped off the cliff, cut off the fingernails that I'd had to play the classical guitar and entered this world of playing the lute in quite a different way.
Yes, because I was going to say, it isn't something that you could just sort of change your mind, because if once you've cut your nails, you're playing with the flesh of your fingers and that's it, you know, until they grow back again. I mean, you do commit a little bit, don't you?
You do. I mean, I had this fantasy that I could do everything by sticking on fingernails to continue to play the greats of the guitar repertoire, and that involved a lot of time with ping pong balls and super glue. And
Edward Scissorhands.
Basically, one spent so much time fiddling about with one's nails that I didn't really have time to practice anything. So once I'd actually decided to use fingertips, I was then drawn into quite a different feel and quite a different sound world.
Enough about the manicures. Let's hear Nigel playing now. What are we going to hear?
We're going to hear a piece that he recorded in 1981, or at least it came out in 1981. It's by Charles Mouton, who is one of the French school of 17th century lute players, and it's a piece called The Horizon de Monsieur Gautier, and it's a tribute from one lute player to another. Charles Mouton was paying homage to the most famous lute player of the early 17th century, Ennemond Gautier, who established a wonderful school, a very expressive, very sensual lute playing.
Like so much French music, it all represents something. It's like programme music, isn't it? We can actually hear specific things in this.
We can, and this is a funeral piece, but it's not only funereal. You have some very anguished, sad moments, but also recollections of what Gautier was doing in his life. So you have some rather lovely snippets of half-remembered dance music. Actually, I remember on the front of this recording, there is an engraving of Charles Mouton looking very confident, very pleased with himself. And I remember this engraving from the original, which hung in Bob Spencer's house above the fireplace, I think, in the living room. So, again, it's a lovely collaboration between two players, because I don't know what the details were, but presumably he authorised its reproduction for Nigel's recording. Thank you.
lutenist Nigel North. Liz, we've heard the lute there as a soloist and at the beginning of the programme and also accompanying singing. What's its place as part of an ensemble?
Well, this was one of the revelations for me and many others of the early to mid-80s, was when the lute as part of a chamber music ensemble was heard playing continuo, so improvising accompaniments. And this, I think it's fair to say, was really pioneered by Nigel, who took it into the mainstream of most early music ensembles, which had existed quite happily with harpsichord before.
Just for a moment, in case some people aren't quite sure what continuo means, it's a way of sort of emphasising the harmonic patterns and movements, isn't it, by emphasising the bass line of the harmonic movements. Is that right?
Yes, what you have is a written bass line, and then your job is to work from that bass line and add harmony where it needs to be added, or phrase the bass line alone as a solo part, or improvise around that bass line. So really it's a kind of blueprint for what you then do with the music.
So we're going to hear, in fact, Nigel doing something of that in this next piece. It's by an Italian.
Yes, it's by Biagio Marini, who was an Italian violinist composer who came from Brescia. And he was one of the avant-garde in the early 17th century who was writing not only more virtuoso violin music, but also making the role of the bass line much more prominent. In this sonata, it actually says it's for basso e violine. So to me, this was extraordinary that the accompanying instrument could actually be listed first and could be melodically and soloistically as important as the violin. So they're in a real duo situation. Thank you.
Andrew Manzi, the violinist there, the organist John Toll and lutenist Nigel North. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Lucy Skeeping, and my guest today is the lutenist Elizabeth Kenny. Now, Liz, in fact, you were a student when some of the music we've been listening to first came out, weren't you?
Yes, it was a fantastic time to be a student in London, particularly I was then, having been at the Royal Academy, having lessons with Bob Spencer, I was then at the Guildhall doing the same with Nigel and also working with John Toll there. So what would happen was this wonderful link-up between music that they were preparing for recordings that they would bring along for us to have a go at, if you like. And then we would buy the record, as a group of us lute players at the Guildhall School, we would buy the record and slavishly imitate all the best licks and best tricks that we thought Nigel was thinking up. And then, of course, try and do them with various embarrassing results. But I think we learned an awful lot from that and from each other. And there was this great sense of being part of a musical discovery.
I love the way you talk about licks, because I know it's been said 100 times before, but there is so much in common in a way with the approach like jazz, really, isn't there? Because you are improvising around an existing tune quite often.
Yes, and I think particularly when you're in your early 20s, you're interested in all the kind of twiddly bits and all the clever bits. And the wonderful thing about Nigel as a teacher was that he would, with just the odd raised eyebrow, actually remind you that it was all really about the structure of the music and about the bass line itself.
Stop having so much fun.
So one ended up learning, really, that there was a basic structure that it was quite helpful to get out, and then adding one's own improvised additions was a fun part as well. So you ended up being equipped to deal with many different kinds of music as well as just the one piece that you'd actually learnt in that way.
We're going to hear some Italian music now for solo theorbo. Now, this is, in a sense, the sort of height of sophistication when it comes to lute music, isn't it? Because it's complex, and being Italian, it's very, very modern.
Yes, it's by Alessandro Piccinini, and there are two pieces, a toccata and a ciacconna, and both of them were absolutely up-to-the-minute forms. The toccata was a kind of free improvisation that was developed particularly by Piccinini and the other famous theorbo player, Hieronymus Capsberger. And the ciacconna was an Italian dance, so it's a ground bass, a sequence of chords that repeats over and over again with some very exciting variations. Piccinini actually claimed that he was in the forefront of all these technological advances, saying that he invented the theorbo's cousin, the archlute. And he also said that he was the one who thought up the idea of very long bass strings. And whether he did or not, there's a long and interesting correspondence between him and his lute maker, which flies to and fro, with the lute maker saying, "You can't possibly do this," and Piccinini saying, "But I need to, because I want to write this music." And I think it probably was ever thus that the technology and the music and the players all kind of tussle for who's going to win out. And I think the result was a very good one for the lute. Thank you.
music by Piccinini, toccata and chicana, played on the theorbo, or large lute, by Nigel North. It's incredible what a full sound you can get, isn't it, Liz, from this one plucked instrument, as we heard there. I mean, I suppose you could say there are some comparisons to be made with the Bach solo sonatas, although, of course, they were a century later. I mean, did Bach actually write anything specifically for the lute?
No, that's the short answer. The long answer is that he wrote the lute suites, of course, which are famously titled, but were actually written for the Lautenwerke, which in a way is what all lutenists wish the lute could be, where it was set up like a keyboard, so you had the facility for playing with all 10 fingers, but it had the sound of a lute. So it's really a keyboard instrument, the Lautenwerke. So these pieces actually fit on the lute the least well of all the music that is generally played on the lute. However, there are various manuscripts written by contemporaries and friends of Bach. Music for solo violin and solo cello were arranged for the lute, and this seems to be very much associated with the heart of the lute sound. And there's also a bit of evidence about Bach meeting the most famous 18th century lute player in Europe, Sylvius Leopold Weiss, and apparently they had an improvisation competition or friendly exchange, shall we say, around 1739. So we know that Bach was very taken with the sound of the lute, and the lute crops up in odd cantatas and famously in the St. John Passion. But Bach always wrote his music for the lute in staff notation rather than in tablature, which most lute players used. So in a sense, he left the how and the details of how this would fit on the instrument to the player. And this is what distinguished players like Nigel have done. They've taken music written primarily for the violin and the cello and made it into idiomatic lute music, just as Weiss or these other players, Christian Weyrauch and another player called Monsieur Schuster, just as they would have done with or without Bach's knowledge and approval.
Thank you.
The Chaconne from Bach's Solo Violin Sonata in D minor, arranged for lute and performed there by Nigel North. My thanks to Elizabeth Kenny for coming in and talking to us today.
This week's Early Music Show was presented by Lucy Skeeping and produced by Les Pratt. And you can download a podcast of that programme from the Early Music Show pages on the Radio 3 website.